This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're still looking at some fallout from the Republican attempt to repeal and replace Obamacare. While the Senate failed to get the majority to vote in favor of their bill, there are still strategies the White House could use to undermine the Affordable Care Act.
Some senators are planning to forge ahead with hearings that are aimed at finding ways to stabilize these markets, especially in the pockets around the country where customers who are seeking coverage simply have no insurers to choose from.
You know, Margaret, the insurance exchanges set up under the Affordable Care Act are doing pretty well. The marketplaces are stabilizing in states where there's support for the Affordable Care Act. The ACA has remained intact for the time being, with Mitch McConnell's last effort to repeal falling short of votes.
Well, Mark, it's important to note here that the senators who quickly announced that they wouldn't support repeal, that was Senator Capito of West Virginia, Senator Collins of Maine, said this would seriously derail efforts to curb the opioid epidemic, not just in their states, but around the country.
On that note, Margaret, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and other experts predict that the number of overdose deaths is expected to increase this year from last year's high of roughly 50,000.
This is truly an unbelievable and frightening public health crisis, Mark, with no simple solutions and no end in sight. We thought we would review an interview we did within the past year with Dr. Anna Lemke. She's an addiction specialist at Stanford Medical Center, and she's written a very compelling and important book on the topic, Drug Dealer MDs, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop. It's a very tough look at how opioid prescribing got so out of control.
Laurie Robertson also stops by, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, who is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you. And we'll get to our interview with Dr. Anna Lemke in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. After a seven-year odyssey to repeal and replace Obamacare, it appears the GOP has hit a dead end. The Republican-controlled Senate plan to replace the Affordable Care Act failed to garner enough support from all Republicans, and a follow-up attempt to simply repeal the law never got off the ground either. So what's next in the quest for health reform? The highly partisan Congress is likely to have to crack the door open, at least slightly, to the idea of bipartisan negotiation to address what needs fixing in the health care law. Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, said he felt it was unfortunate that they might have to start negotiating now across the aisle. He claimed Democrats were unwilling to concede structural challenges in the Affordable Care Act. President Trump, who had campaigned heavily on repeal and replace of Obamacare, has said publicly that maybe he should just let it die. Meanwhile, funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, is going to expire after September 30th. Bills to address the subsidy payments and CHIP will likely require 60 votes for passage in the Senate. It's a barometer of how inclined Republicans and Democrats might be to work together on these important issues. Meanwhile, entering into the dog days of summer, there are renewed concerns across the nation's southern tier about the resurgence of the Zika virus. And cities like Houston are making ready. The nation's fourth largest city has increased budgets for mosquito control, partnering with tech giants Microsoft and Google to initiate innovative approaches to containing mosquito-borne illnesses. Zika infections across Central America and the Caribbean are down significantly, about 90%. But the risk still remains. There are outbreaks being reported in the countries of Peru and Argentina. Currently, there are about 20 vaccines for Zika in varying stages of development. The opioid crisis has led to a rise in another health reality, a dramatic spike in the number of babies being born opioid dependent as well. Rates for babies born to opioid withdrawal has increased nearly fivefold in the U.S., and the problem is particularly acute in rural areas. Meanwhile, Missouri has become the final state in the nation to create a prescription drug monitoring program. Governor Eric Greitens signed an executive order aimed at combating a scourge that's killed more than 900 residents in the last year. Missouri has been the lone holdout for many years. The nation's governors met in Rhode Island for the annual meeting recently and held a special session on the mounting opioid crisis. There's significant bipartisan agreement that a national agenda needs to be scaled up across multiple sectors to address what's become the leading cause of accidental death in this country. And trying to lose weight? Well, artificial sweeteners may not get you there. A study done at the University of Manitoba found that there's no clear benefit for weight loss, and there's a potential association with increased weight gain, diabetes, and other health concerns. The observational studies actually found a small increase in BMI associated with the use of sweeteners. Every day, about 41% of American adults consume some product with an artificial sweetener in it. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Anna Lemke, Chief of Addiction Medicine and Assistant Professor at Stanford University School of Medicine, with a primary research focus on why patients become addicted to prescription drugs. Dr. Lemke has published over 50 peer-reviewed articles in publications such as the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the American Medical Association. She is the author of Drug Dealer MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop. She earned her undergrad degree at Yale and her medical degree from Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Lemke, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, as you so clearly articulated, we're in this midst of a devastating public health crisis in the country. Some 50,000 people a year are dying from overdoses, which is sort of reminds me back to the days of the Vietnam War. Your book, Drug Dealer MD, takes an unflinching look at what you see as one of the critical components of the epidemic, the dramatic rise in the number of prescription clinicians have written for opioids in recent years. And I'm wondering if you could help our listeners understand the scope of America's addiction crisis.
Yeah, I'm glad you referenced the Vietnam era, because that was the opioid epidemic just prior to this one, and this one certainly surpasses that in scope and devastation. Drug overdoses today are the leading cause of accidental death in this country, surpassing deaths due to motor vehicle accidents for the first time in our history. And of the 50,000 annual drug-related deaths, about half of those involved some kind of prescription drug. There's been a quadrupling of the number of deaths since 1999, and along with that, a quadrupling in the number of prescriptions doctors have written for opioid painkillers. So what we have here is really a very clear epidemic of overprescribing. Just to give people perspective on this, is that the U.S. consumes about 90% of the world's prescription opioids, while constituting only about 4% of the world's population.
Amazing.
Well, Dr. Lemke, I think it's important for our listeners to maybe start a little bit at the beginning of what we now understand about addiction, from thinking of this as a moral failure or understanding just how complex the medical, behavioral, and psychiatric underpinnings are. What's the description of addiction, the diagnostic description, if you will, and what does this mean within the larger context of healthcare and how we address it?
Probably the best way to describe the disease of addiction is to tell you an anecdote about a patient of mine who called me in desperation one day and said, you know, Dr. Lemke, I'm surrounded by empty vodka bottles. I cannot stop drinking. Can you help me? This is somebody who fully recognized that she had the disease of addiction to alcohol. She clearly could describe her situation, but she was unable to stop drinking without help. In order to get her help, I had to tell her to go to her nearest emergency room and tell them that she was suicidal. And she said, but Dr. Lemke, I'm not suicidal. That's why I'm calling you. I want to live. And I said to her, I know that, but if you go to the emergency room and tell them that you want to be admitted for alcohol detox, they won't admit you, because insurance companies don't pay for that. So you have to tell them that you're suicidal, and then they'll admit you, and then they'll treat your alcohol detox. So what we have here is a huge, huge medical condition, public health problem, and yet we don't have a way to get people ready access and ready treatment paid for by their insurance companies. So instead, what are we doing? We're spending $400+ billion per year paying for the downstream effects of addiction.
In your book, Drug Dealer MD, you focus on what you call prescription drugs as the new gateway drugs. And I'm wondering what role the pharmaceutical industry has played in this latest chapter of the drug addiction scenario, and well-meaning doctors were duped into complicity.
Right. So my title, drug dealer MD, is, you know, intentionally provocative, but also a little bit misleading, because I really do feel that this epidemic is driven primarily not by pill mill doctors exchanging prescriptions for cash, but by well-intentioned, compassionate doctors. And the way that doctors were really duped is that they were misled to believe that the evidence supported the use of opioids in the treatment of chronic pain. Now, we now know that there is essentially no evidence that opioids, when prescribed long-term, helps chronic pain. The reason for that is because people develop tolerance through the process called neuroadaptation, and the opioids just simply don't work anymore. So what happened in the 1980s is some thought leaders within medicine suggested that we should more liberally prescribe opioids. Out of good intentions came a bad idea. It was essentially the pharmaceutical industry. What they did was more like a Trojan horse approach, and they infiltrated big medicine by making all kinds of partnerships with the Joint Commission, with the FDA, funneling money into these organizations, into pain societies, that opioids work long-term for pain, even though there was really scant evidence. In this era of so-called evidence-based medicine, there's enormous pressure on doctors to practice medicine supported by the evidence, and they were told that the evidence supported using opioids chronically for pain, even though that wasn't true. So it got to be a kind of a groupthink. And then, of course, there were many factors within healthcare delivery that made using opioids to treat complex problems like pain an easy solution.
I appreciate that you acknowledge the clinicians are motivated to do right by their patients, but there's this conundrum, a dramatic lack of training in this area of understanding and assessing and diagnosing and managing and treating chronic pain. What are we going to do about this to help both clinicians and consumers move forward to get a better handle on how we manage chronic pain going forward?
I do feel positive that we're about to make a big shift in medical school education. I was recently part of a White House symposium, a lot of educators from around the country talking about how we can revamp the medical school curriculum to better address the issue of addiction. But we currently have a terrible situation in which physicians learn almost nothing in most medical schools on how to target and treat addiction, and much of their pain education emphasizes getting patients on opioids. And let me tell you, it's a lot easier to get them on than to get off. I don't think education alone is going to be enough. Mm-hmm. We really have to restructure some of the incentives within the healthcare delivery system.
We're speaking today with Dr. Anna Lemke, Chief of Addiction Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. She's author of Drug Dealer MD. Dr. Lemke, I want to pull the thread a little on this notion of solutions. And one of the things that we do at our Weizmann Institute is that we have a nationwide pain echo. Physicians and nurse practitioners, other providers are able to present cases to addiction experts, psychiatry, nursing, along with acupuncture and the like. What other tools are you seeing out there that the practicing provider might be able to use because they just don't have the right tools?
Fortunately, there's tremendous outreach now. The ECHO program is a great example of how to tap into addiction experts to learn how to handle these complex patients. There's a push in some states to get doctors to register and even access their prescription drug monitoring program, which is a good first step. Again, what concerns me, though, is beyond education, we need to actually make it economically feasible and rewarding for healthcare systems and individual doctors to pursue these efforts. So you talk about how you have a team-based approach. You've got the orthopedic surgeon with the psychiatrist and the social worker and the primary care doctor. Fantastic. But I would ask you, do you get reimbursed for that time?
No.
Right. You don't. So, you know, it's out of the goodness of your heart and you're aware of the public health crisis, and that's fantastic, but we really need to restructure the reimbursement strategy so that we incentivize doctors to do the right thing, because otherwise you're not going to get systemic reform.
Dr. Lemke, it's really just within the last decade that those of us on the front lines of primary care have been asked to play an active role in the treatment of drug dependency, particularly medication-assisted treatment, Suboxone being the most common one. Talk about the use of medical interventions for addiction management, if you will.
Yes, I think it's fascinating that primary care doctors are expected to solve this problem, like as if they didn't have enough to do already. All right, so let's talk about Suboxone for a second. I have also seen life-changing success with Suboxone, and the evidence is overwhelming that it's very effective, not just to reduce However, I am very concerned that this is kind of a typical knee-jerk reaction, yet one more pill that we're prescribing. And although Suboxone is effective, I don't think it's as effective as it could be if it were combined with psychosocial interventions, then really it should be. There are lots of different interventions that work for the treatment of addiction. You know, individual therapy, group therapy, family therapy. There are other medications besides Suboxone for opioid addiction, namely something called naltrexone, which blocks the mu opioid receptor. And so it can also, in those individuals, they report actual decreased cravings. So that's a fascinating phenomenon. And then there are also a lot of community-level interventions that are very helpful.
You know, you have the pharmaceutical industry, which is developing and promoting drugs, and you have the FDA, which is empowered to really review drugs to improve the public health and protecting consumers. And something went wrong here. What would you say are the strengths and weaknesses in that relationship between the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry, and what could be a better process?
So the FDA was essentially asleep at the wheel while the prescription opioid crisis was unfolding. Even as people were dying of prescription opioid overdoses, they were doing very little to prevent pharma from misbranding opioids as non-addictive. In addition to approving new drugs, is to police these drugs after they're out there and make sure there aren't new adverse consequences that come up. And they really didn't do this. Even as, for example, Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin, were advertising that less than 1% of patients would get addicted. The FDA did nothing about it. The other thing about the FDA is they have a very compromised relationship with pharmacy, in which the pharmaceutical industry advises them on how to devise their studies to approve opioids. In the 1990s, the FDA changed their approval process for new opioids to a study design called enriched enrollment. Essentially, it's a way of making it easier for new opioids to get approved. And they did this, you know, in collusion at large meetings funded by Big Pharma. So they rescheduled hydrocodone products to Schedule 2 to make it harder for doctors to prescribe them. That was a step forward. But essentially, in 2013, they approved Zohydro, which is a long-acting formulation of hydrocodone. The FDA is now strongly promoting what they call abuse-deterrent alternatives of opioids. So what does this mean? Formulations of opioids that are hard to crush and snort or crush and inject. However, there's no evidence that abuse-deterrent formulations mitigate the risk of addiction because the most common way to misuse opioids is to just ingest them as you normally would,
right?
It's an example of a recent abuse-deterrent formulation, Opana, released in 2011, was supposedly an abuse-deterrent formulation of an opioid, and it was at the center of the HIV epidemic in Indiana. The FDA and the pharmaceutical industry should not be cooperating on the level that they're cooperating. The FDA has to do a better job policing. They shouldn't be approving more opioids. We have enough.
Well, Dr. Lemke, I'm sure you've been very engaged in following policies that have been discussed. What should we and our listeners look forward to possibly seeing in terms of legislative or policy changes?
Well, as you know, Obama pledged $1.1 billion to try to fight opioid addictions. A lot of that has gone into increasing access to Suboxone prescribing, which is great because, as I said before, it works. But I would love to see some of those monies go toward psychosocial interventions and actually paying doctors to spend time helping their patients get off of opioids, which is a long-term and laborious process, as well as providing non-opioid alternatives to pain, from psychotherapy to acupuncture to trigger point massage, whatever it is. You know, if you're going to ask primary care doctors to take care of not just diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease, but also addiction, homelessness, and unemployment, that you give them the resources to do that.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Anna Lemke, Chief of Addiction Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine and author of Drug Dealer MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop. You can learn more about her work by going to med.stanford.edu, or you can follow her on Twitter at Stanford Med or at Drug Dealer MD. Dr. Lemke, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you for having me.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Republican senators revised their health care bill, the Better Care Reconciliation Act, but that wasn't enough to garner the support needed to pass the legislation. What were some of the changes to the latest effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act? The revised Senate bill would have enabled insurers who sell plans on the state or federal marketplaces to also sell non-compliant plans on the individual market outside of those marketplaces. A non-compliant plan could deny coverage or charge more based on health status, and they wouldn't have to meet minimum benefit requirements or a limit on out-of-pocket cost sharing. Compliant plans would still be governed by those rules on the marketplaces, and they'd still have to offer coverage regardless of pre-existing conditions. They also would have received funding for several years to help lower costs, since policyholders with high health costs would likely choose those compliant plans. The revised bill still would institute a per capita cap or a block grant option for Medicaid funding, but it would have allowed the cap to be lifted in areas where public health emergencies are declared. Unlike the first Senate bill and the House GOP bill, the revised bill would have kept the ACA's 0.9% additional Medicare tax and 3.8% tax on investment income for high-income earners. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office hadn't yet released an analysis of the revised legislation when it became clear the Senate Republicans didn't have the votes to pass it. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he would instead bring a vote on a bill that partially repealed the ACA with a two-year delay. A replacement would have to be worked out separately. But enough Republican senators have come out against a partial repeal to block that effort, too. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. If music soothes the savage beast, the question they want to answer at the Sync Project is, how exactly? There are lots of anecdotal studies supporting music's ability to trigger memory or boost endurance or focus, but virtually nothing is known about how music truly impacts our physiological and neurological state. This is the question that intrigued scientist Keiki Kuranam, a systems biology PhD from Harvard, who wondered, how could music be scientifically harnessed as a powerful precision medicine tool? They formed the Sync Project with a cross-section of neuroscientists, biologists, audio engineers, even some rock stars like Peter Gabriel, and started by using artificial intelligence systems to analyze existing playlists that purport to promote relaxation, induce sleep, enhance focus, or athletic performance.
And once we have this set of songs that our machine learning algorithms predict to be effective for a specific activity, we can then run studies using these devices like your smartwatches, your activity trackers, and actually look at how effective indeed is that song for that purpose.
Kuranam and her colleagues note that most of us self-medicate with music already, so why not harness this ubiquitous tool that's available to all of us and develop strategies and systems that might replace pharmacological interventions with musical ones? The Sync Project is seeking 1 million volunteers to offer their music suggestions.
So we're literally walking around with, 14 million songs in our pocket every single day. So we saw a great opportunity on really being able to understand how music was affecting us, both our psychological health as well as our physiology.
Kuranam and her team see vast potential for reducing reliance on drugs by crafting personalized music interventions in the management of a variety of complex conditions, such as pain management, PTSD, even Parkinson's disease.
In Parkinson's disease, patients have trouble coordinating movements. So by playing them the right kind of music, It can be an external auditory support they have that's going to help them walk more smoothly.
The SYNC project, combining computer technology and neuroscience and musicology to harness the healing powers inherent in music. Now that is a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.